Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad. My guest is a product innovator and designer who lives in the notable design capital of Munich, Germany. Had the pleasure of visiting there once. He started his design career in the U.S., creating custom mountain bike frames in Minneapolis that carried his name, Mark Zay. You might have seen one of his frames. He has worked for product design giant IDEO in the U.S. and also helped to lead the office in Germany, as well as consulting independently to numerous companies, applying design thinking, and is now at Bose, the audio technology powerhouse. He also leads the entrepreneurship program at the Munich Business School. I invited him to share his insights on using design thinking, which he recently wrote about in the PDMA Essentials book titled Design and Design Thinking. His chapter is called The Key Role of Stories and Prototype in a Design Thinking Product Development Process. To see the show notes for this episode, go to theeverydayinnovator.com/041. My thanks to Product Innovation Educators, who sponsors this podcast. That is where I and my colleagues provide online training for product managers and innovators. If you want to stand out as a product manager, check out productinnovationeducators.com. Mark, I appreciate you sharing your experience with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Chad. I appreciate it a lot.
Let's just dive into your background with design thinking. Where did you get your experience? How did you first get involved with design thinking?
When I first met the thing that turned into what we call design thinking today, I was working at IDEO. I started there actually 8th of January 2000. I remember that because it was because of the drive out to California after New Year's.
Were you driving from your home in Minneapolis or somewhere else?
Yeah, that's right. We actually loaded everything up, or half of our stuff up, into our car and headed out there, and the other half went via moving van. And
it's a long drive.
You know, driving through all these different landscapes on the way out there.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it was. But when I got there, I stepped into a culture where they were doing something that we called at that point user-centered design. Mm-hmm. And, it's basically working with people who have more or less defined that discipline, if you will, and the thing that has become design thinking. So I was working with Jane Fulton Surrey and David Kelly and Bill Moggridge and these guys. And basically, it added discipline to an approach that I'd sort of been using by accident for a lot of years. But they had a whole discipline around it, and they were building a lot of processes around it. And it earned the name design thinking actually quite a few years later.
Mm, okay. So it was that initial time at IDEO, and that's who I think of. I'm sure there were influences from other places, but if I'm asked, where does design thinking come from? I'm like, well, that's what IDEO was doing before it was called design thinking.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I was trying to figure out where the name came from, and I've read different books about it and stuff. And I think David Kelly probably ended up sort of calling it that when he put together the D School.
Yeah, probably fair to attribute it to him at least.
Yeah, I think that was around 2003 or so.
Yeah. Stanford's D School has become quite popular as a place for students and executives to come learn about design thinking.
Yeah, they're really successful. I mean, they've got the D School in Potsdam, also by Berlin, and I think they've opened another in near Paris. I think they have several now.
So if I don't make it to the California one, I might make it out to France. I'll have to look into that.
That might be nice.
And I'm surprised some of the everyday innovators that are listening, a lot of us would love to go work for IDEO because of the reputation in design and product development. Can you just share real quick how you ended up there? What was your path to become an IDEO contributor?
It's kind of a strange story. Was finishing my engineering degree at the University of Minnesota. I had owned a successful product development company before that. The reason I'd gone for my engineering degree is that I wanted to change what I was doing and run bigger projects, get involved in bigger things. And I decided I wasn't going to start my own company. I was going to go work for somebody and basically learn how to do bigger projects. And this is at a time, this is 1999, so the internet's kind of so-so at this point. Mm-hmm. And I started to apply at local companies, and I was a pretty strange guy for them. I was too senior, and there weren't that many where I lived. And a friend of mine, who now runs a company, I think, called US Microscrew, a guy named Jake Levine, said, hey, I found this website that's got like all these great design companies on it. He said, you should send your resume to all of them. And so I did. And I sent about 200 resumes, and I got two answers.
Wow.
This was you got to be able to take a lot of rejection. But one of them was a company in New York called Hoberman that does space linkages. Mm-hmm. And the other one was a company in California called IDEO. And at that point, I'd seen Hoberman, but I'd never heard of IDEO before. And I talked to my advisor at the University of Minnesota, a guy named Will Durfee, who's still there. And he heard that and he just went wild. And he said, hey, you got to see this video that I got with the shopping cart thing in it.
Oh, that's famous. I'll try to link to that in the show notes. It's come up before on this podcast.
Yeah, and I'd never seen it before. So I watched this and my friend Jake, who was there, the guy who's now running this big company in the U.S., looked at that and he said, you'd fit right into that. And so I went out there. You know, they called me up. I had a little phone interview. I flew out there. I had a day of interviews, and they gave me an offer a week later.
Perfect.
So I had a very unusual experience. They'd seen work that I'd done before, though, so I didn't know that. So I kind of had a bit of an advantage in the interview process.
That's what I was curious about, was what do you think made your background specifically appealing to them? And in the introduction, I shared that you used to make custom bikes. Was that what they saw before or something else?
After I did custom bicycle frames, while I was doing it, I had a couple of parallel tracks in my career. I opened a product development company with another friend of mine in Minneapolis. And he's a crazy inventor, and we crank out all sorts of cool stuff. And one of the things that we invented was a fluid resistance trainer for bicycles.
Okay.
And IDEO had seen that. And they'd also seen some of the stuff that I'd done for a company in the U.S. called Quality Bicycle Products. I helped them design and launch a whole line of stuff called Alloy Accents. I don't know what it's called now. All sorts of accessories and stuff. And so they'd kind of seen all this stuff. And the fluid bicycle trainer actually ended up being a kind of a thing that's licensed all over the world now. It's a pretty successful invention. Had its hiccups when it was first launched as a product, but that's all been ironed out now. But yeah, that's what they saw. And so they've kind of seen things I've done. And they also liked my approach, because when I described to them how I invented this stuff or what I saw that created the insight to invent it, that's kind of what they're looking for.
And that's probably the important thing for us to dive into that actually led to more of your work with design thinking, how those pieces came together that they saw that they appreciated. And I'm sure you probably still practice, just refine now. So in the chapter, you share a framework or a process for product development. What are the components of that framework?
I need to open my picture here quickly.
As you mentioned that picture, I'll try to share this in the show notes too, a diagram of what that process looks like.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah. It basically is, there's three blocks in the thing that I show in the book, in the framework that I show in the book. The first major block of work in the design thinking process is to identify the needs of the customer, the user needs, or the needs of the, not necessarily the user if it's B2B. Find the value proposition, basically. Figure out what's worth doing. And then the second thing is this cycle of build, test, iterate, refine. And then the third block is validate and communicate what it is that you found, because you need to deploy stuff within an organization, get people on board and so forth, and actually figure out if the thing is broadly needed. And the fourth block, which I don't put in the book really, is a pretty straightforward product development process after you've figured out if you've identified the right value proposition.
Very good. And I appreciate how you laid this out. And so it starts with that, identify needs, find the value proposition. And as I'm looking also at your diagram here, you don't use the traditional terms that are now laid out in design thinking. And is that just because of your background with, like I know IDEO did use the traditional terms in the beginning because they didn't exist yet, right? You thought about it differently.
Right. I don't even know if they use them now because, IDEO is a creative agency, and every time we would do a proposal, everybody has to reinvent everything. You know, they're creative people. They're constantly refining stuff. I've worked with a lot of other agencies and a lot of other companies that are doing design thinking since then. And everybody uses slightly different terminology for this stuff that fits with their internal processes, mm-hmm. but they kind of mean the same things. So, you know, I heard some feedback that, you know, why aren't you using the HPI terms for that? And the answer is pretty simply that I don't know what the current HPI terms are. I don't have a lot of contact with them, but my familiarity with the process is kind of pre-HPI.
Mm-hmm. And can you share what that is, HPI?
Sorry, that's the Hasso-Plattner Institute. That's the D School.
And that's where, I guess, if there were official terms, that would be from the D School for design thinking.
Right. You know, I don't actually know if they can even, can they lay claim to that?
That's a good question. I guess whoever gets there first, right, has the prior art to do so. But the point is that, and I think this is helpful too for listeners to hear that, you know, there's freedom in what we call these things, right? But the big steps of going through, of identifying those needs, making sure that there's value built into what we're trying to do for the customer, the user, going through that prototyping iteration phase to refine the value proposition and the concept and the product, and then validating that with users and, as you said, communicating it broadly. Those are the big buckets of activities that have to get done when we're developing a new product.
Yep. And they have to get done in that order. You can't do one of them. You can't jump ahead.
Yeah. I think the times that people have tried to jump ahead, like, you know, there's sometimes the let's start building now and we'll figure it out along the way approach. Yep. We just waste so much effort. And a lot of time we end up building something no one wants, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Or losing a lot of money fixing stuff that's on the market.
Now, as you described this process in the chapter, I know you spent a lot of time talking about story. And I want to dive into that some because story has kind of been a recurring theme on this podcast at times in terms of understanding the user, what's the story of the brand. Talk about what story means to you, how that ties in.
Right. So when I start to look for, actually, that's what my chapter is really about. It's about stories and prototyping. And so when I start to look for an offer or look for how people are behaving, I want to build a story about it. I want to understand what they're doing and be able to build a narrative about it that I can communicate to other people. Mm-hmm. That way we can start to work on it together because human knowledge is really captured up in stories one way or another. You know, you can't understand raw data. It has to have it has to be held in narrative. It has to have meaning attached to it. And so stories really are the foundation of the process. And so you need to start out with understanding what's existing and then be able to tell a story about the future that's plausible, that's based on what you've observed with customer behavior or elements of customer behavior that you can take ahead and alter. So that's kind of how I use story. There's kind of no end to it, but basically you take facts or vision and build it into a narrative that makes sense.
And a key element there for me is when you talk about the future and being able to use story to kind of paint a picture and envision the future in a compelling way that yep. creates excitement, right, for the users, the customers, and for the people building the product.
Yep, exactly. But the story actually has even more functional purposes than that. And that is, I talk about this in the chapter too, and that is that once the story begins to take on life, you should be able to act it out. And just like in a movie, you can tell whether it's real or not as soon as you can start acting it out. And you can tell whether it's valid or not. You can tell what people would do and wouldn't do because your body's moving. And once you start to be able to do that, you can tap into all these other types of cognition and knowledge that are in the human brain that are not attached to voice.
So I think I might need an example to help make this a little more tangible for me. So if you're working with a product team, how would you be talking with them, how would you be applying this concept of story as you're working with them?
Okay, so just an example. I had a little design workshop here the other day with a visiting designer from the design center in the United States. And he and I were starting to play around with a bunch of technology concepts and based upon some human behavior that we had observed in some research. And so we built some little prototypes here and we started playing around with it and acting out little scenarios. So we started to build like a little sort of a story fragment about how I would interact with this in the future. How could I apply it? And we built out a little scenario that's, you know, maybe about 45 seconds long about how these technologies could be applied in some transactions between people. Hmm. And in order to make that communicatable, we just very quickly made a video of it. And so it's a story that we can tell. We could tell it in words, but by acting it out in video, we've communicated also with motion and image and sound and things like that.
Okay.
So that's what I mean.
Okay. And so you're telling the story and in this sense, coming up with scenarios and simulating how this product concept could actually be used in the future if it was real, to try to make that experience real to you and then identify maybe the problems with the story.
Yep, exactly. And you can look at that video and you can say, hey, you know, I believe it all the way up to here. And then you can say, well, what if, and you could actually act it out and shoot a little video or whatever, build your own thumbnail storyboard and say, I think it would be like this, though. And then it basically becomes alive and it becomes something that a team can work on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You don't happen to have that video available publicly, do you?
I cannot show you that stuff.
I thought that might be the case, but you know, I knew the listeners would be wanting me to ask, so I had to ask.
Yeah, I can't show it to you. I actually, unfortunately, I have very, very little of this kind of work that I can show publicly.
Yeah, understand. And I'll try to provide this link too in the show notes to your personal website that just highlights a few of your products. And I know when people go and look at that, everyone listening has to know that that's just a tiny, a minute amount of all the things that you have contributed to. And as we've talked before doing this interview, a lot of your products, as you just said, you know, you're not at liberty to share your involvement with it. Lots of products that we would recognize and know.
It's the downside of actually being the kind of the guy behind the scenes is you don't get to talk about it unless there's a patent or something like that. And
right.
Often people don't want you to disclose even more than is already publicly disclosed through the patent filing or whatever.
Absolutely. So this element of story you couple with prototype also in your process. Can you tell us what a prototype is and how you use it with story?
Yeah. So a prototype is, in my opinion, is something that you can engage with physically. It could be a mocked up website, you know, that runs on a mobile phone that you did like a flash animation or something like that. It enables users to pretend that they're interacting with content.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, the basic, you know, stuff hot glued together to represent a kind of an artifact that people can play with. Prototype, that word has a whole bunch of different meanings. You know, in some places, as you move further into the product development process, a prototype could be the first time that you built an aircraft carrier or something too. It's really the kind of the first of its kind. And in my world, it's something that's a tool. It helps you communicate. It helps you test things. So I always tell people that you shouldn't build a prototype until you have an idea of what you're trying to discover. And prototypes are usually built to discover stuff and be modified and chopped up and changed.
And in your product development process, there's a iteration loop through this too. So
yeah.
I guess that would suggest we would expect the early prototypes by design, by purpose, you probably want those to look really rough, don't you? To just get feedback from customers before you start making something that looks like it's kind of more real.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're building, if you're building physical products, usually as you enter that loop of, you know, build, test, refine, you are going to separate out the ones that looks like prototypes from the works like prototypes. So what you want to do is be able to create a bunch of different things. Actually, prototypes can include even things like renderings, like how something could look.
Mm-hmm.
That could be accompanied by some kind of a Frankenstein model that actually performs some function so that people can imagine what it could look like and then kind of experience what it could do. So, as you move through that cycle a few times of iterating and refining and testing and observing and improving your concept, the thing becomes better and better and better and better. And that usually don't unite a design or it looks like prototype or the works like prototype until you're at the design validation phase, which is the beginning of the validate and communicate broadly block that I described earlier.
Okay, so when you actually believe you have a product that is correct for your customer, that provides the value, then you're bringing those two together, the looks like and the works like.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's not worth investing, you know, when we enter that build, test, iterate, refine phase, it's not worth investing in a whole complete product because it's not right anyway. You have to go into that phase knowing that it's not right.
Okay.
It's probably not right. There's something wrong and you don't know what it is yet.
So if we pull the example out from the shopping cart video that IDEO is famous for back that Nightline did, I'll try to provide the link for that. would an example then in that shopping cart context be, so the, you know, the bundle together quick thing might be using popsicle sticks and hot glue to make something that could look like this new shopping cart. And at the same time, we might have someone working in a 3D graphical environment designing a more refined version of that to say, you know, this is what we think, you know, the real thing might look like, but this is something that you can touch and start getting your hands on, and, you know, it has some functionality.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the things that I believe strongly in actually is haptic feedback. If you're going to build a real product, a physical product, you should be able to put something in people's hands right away, because there's cognition that happens in the part of your brain that's connected to your hands. That part of your brain is actually much, much larger than the part of your brain that's connected to speech. But in, you know, because of our university system, it's easier to teach the speech part. So you want to get stuff in people's hands, and then they think differently, and then they start to do stuff differently than they might imagine. And that's what you want to see that right away. You want to get people involved and engaged in your concept as quickly as possible.
Okay. And using something physical helps with that they're actually touching, feeling it, having that feedback.
It would be something improvised. Yep.
And I kind of alluded to this earlier, but I wanted to ask it directly to make sure I don't misunderstand you. The question has come up before in my experience and with designers too, about how good should your prototypes look, right? And the issue really is, if you make a prototype for the first time, you're asking customers about it, if it looks too much like it could be a real product, customers are less likely to interact with it and give you feedback because it looks like it could be a real product, right? Not something that's in the works. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's true. That's funny. So when I worked at IDEO and I started to work a lot with young designers, one of the things that I had to work on with them usually was something that I call appropriateness. And that is, what's the right level for that we need right now? You know, because there's no end to what you could do to make something look good or work well or whatever. And I agree with what you said. You know, people do respond to that. If something looks really polished, they think it's finished.
Right.
And it's not just the people that you show it to. It's also your customers or your boss or whatever. If you show something really polished, they think it's done. So it's for your own risk mitigation for your project, it's a good idea to keep things looking rough or right at the level of just testing what you need to have tested or discover what you need to discover as long as you can. So I definitely don't advise doing something really polished early, or you'll get in trouble.
Okay.
People will lock into it.
We get attached to those things, right? And I've been on the side of that as a customer giving feedback, where I kind of feel like, wow, you guys must have spent a lot of time on this because it looks so good. I really hate to tell you to, you know, make changes at this point.
Yep, that's very true. Yeah, people respond really well to, if you ask people to imagine stuff. I think this is the part that people who have come from a non-design thinking process can't imagine is true. But if you ask people, if you hand people some chunks of styrofoam that are cut up into something representative and show them some sketches and renderings and a storyboard that you drew with post-it notes, people are able to fill in those gaps really easily. They're right. Able to imagine what you're talking about.
Yep.
And they'll help you develop it. They may not be artists or developers themselves, but you know, people love to engage with stuff like that. That's what we all did as kids.
Yeah. I have an example that will blow the mind of some software user interface designers, but a person told me the story once that she was having a very difficult time getting a group of users to interact with the prototypes that she had put together, wireframes for the user interface. Yep. And finally came in with pieces of flannel and a flannel board and scissors and said, okay, you show me what you would do. And they took it and ran with it, and they came up with what they needed.
Yep, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. When we're doing prototypes of interfaces, I've done a lot of times where I've just showed a prototype of an interface. It's just like a flip chart or something.
Mm-hmm.
I just talked to a student about that today. She at the business school where I teach. She was talking to me about how to prototype an app idea that she had, and they had some app developer in India already working on this. I'm like, you know, you have to figure out if you've hit a customer need first. You know, just draw it in a notebook or something and ask people to imagine it. Take it through, your customer through it in the right order and ask people for feedback that way. Don't start building early.
Right. Yeah. Make it as simple as possible.
Exactly. Yep.
It's all that language that we're getting used to about the minimal viable product idea.
Yep. Yep.
And I don't want to take you off on a tangent on that. So let's talk about how these two key things work together more, story and prototyping. So as you're iterating that build, test, refine cycle with the prototype, how are you using story in that process?
Right. So I think just to step into the way that I look at this, for me, stories and prototypes are entwined. They're intertwined. They're not separable. So if you've ever gone into a design group, you'll see these old foam prototypes laying around in the back room and nobody remembers what they are anymore. And if you saw some of the stories attached to them or heard the stories that were attached to them without the prototype, it would be very difficult to understand what the concept was that they were talking about. Hmm. So you'd take a whole lot of words to describe something that can be embodied as a physical object. And so a story and a prototype always are linked together. A story without a prototype is lost, and a prototype without a story is an interesting object or old junk. So you need to have those two things together. A prototype exists within a story to communicate some aspect of the story, to communicate an experience that you can't state in words, mm-hmm. or basically to allow people to act out something that you wouldn't be able to state in words or necessarily completely communicate in images. Mm-hmm. And it's the other way around. The story provides the narrative. A prototype doesn't have any kind of context.
Right.
The story provides a context in the narrative that gives the thing a place.
Okay, so these two aren't really intertwined. And
yeah, you can't really have it. To me, they don't exist separately. It's strange to me to have kind of the guys developing the prototype over in one place and the marketing people developing the story over another place, and then they talk maybe once a week.
Yeah, I think that's where organizations often get in trouble is when they have these handoffs taking place as opposed to the same team working through the entire product development process.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
As you're talking about that, I kind of thought my 13-year-old daughter appreciates acting, and she's gotten quite good at it so far. And certainly not from any of my DNA. That's not me. But the props that are used in theater, those props are part of the story, and you would have to change the story if you change the prop, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's really interesting. Some of the best researchers that I've ever worked with come from theater and acting because they're really good at developing empathy, mm-hmm. and they're also really good at understanding what kinds of artifacts they can take with them to get customer feedback. And they've also been through that experience where they know that if you're on stage, the stage prop that symbolizes a tree is actually pretty rough looking when you're close to it.
Right.
So they have a really good feel for appropriateness already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an excellent point. On my bucket list is to go learn about storytelling and try to become a better storyteller, just because I do appreciate how important it is in so many aspects of life when you're trying to influence others, whether it be on products or anything else.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten to work with some really great ones. It's an art.
So can we put this in the context of a real example? I know you don't have too many you can talk about publicly, but one that you can talk to us about, what the story was and how that flowed into the prototype work and the validation that you did and product coming to market.
One of them that comes to mind is when I worked some years back with Greg LeMond at LeMond Fitness. They approached us to do a kind of a recumbent bicycle trainer. It's called the G-Force RT. I think it's still on the market. It became a very successful product. And, there were a lot of these kinds of products on the market already, and he already had a different kind of a product. And one of the things that we wanted to understand about recumbent trainers then, for the home particularly, is why people would buy them. And so we spent some time looking at how they get bought. We went into various fitness stores and interviewed people in their homes and stuff like that. And it turns out often that that particular kind of an object, which is bought by women, and my customer didn't really fully appreciate that. They understood that, but they didn't fully appreciate it. And one of the things that we had to do then was build up a whole process to understand how the decision gets made to buy a particular product like that. And so we basically built up a bunch of scenarios about how this thing gets into people's homes. And it basically led to the insight that when it's in somebody's home, it shouldn't look like a product. It should look like architecture. And nothing else in the market. I shouldn't say that because Technogym's products look like they're beautiful design. They look like design objects. But so that's actually what drove the design, was observation of who the buyer is, how they interact, how the thing gets home, where it is in their home, and basically building up a kind of a scenario about how what that whole process looks like. And that enabled us to develop a product that would fulfill those needs and fit into that story.
So key to that was the research you did, interviews, ethnographic research, to understand what is that buying process and really what is the trigger for them wanting to buy.
Exactly. And also, where is it when it's in their home?
Yeah, exactly.
How do they use it in their home? Yep.
And so you discovered that if they're going to have this exercise equipment sitting in their home, that they care about how it looks, you know, how does it, you know, it should complement their furniture and fit into their home.
Yeah, it should look like it belongs in your home. And if, you know, otherwise they put it away in a closet and never use it again.
Right. Right. At least if it's out, there's a chance we might use it.
Exactly. You know, one of the aspects about that brand, also the Le Mans brand, is, you know, he means it. You know, he's into fitness, that stuff performs. And that had to definitely be reflected in the story. So it's like, well, if people are going to buy this product, we expect that they also use it really well and they become healthier. And so it had to be, you know, in a place where it would be not put away, because that's one of the insights that we had, is people put it away because it's ugly.
Right. Yeah. Very good. Good experience. Thanks for sharing the example with us. And that started just by having a very good understanding of the customer buying process, you know, not even what they wanted to accomplish with a recumbent bicycle. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to back up further in the buying chain than we think about. So if I can take you back with all the years of experience and design that you have accumulated over your life, if you could go back and tell your 25-year-old version of yourself one thing, what would you share with them?
That's a tough question. Think about all the things my dad said to me now that I should have done. things like, what could I say to myself? I guess the most important thing that I could have done that probably would have made me a lot more successful early on is to listen better. Pay more attention to what people are saying. And I don't mean hear them better and nod at them to acknowledge that, but I mean dig deeper into what they're saying, you know, and build a lot more empathy with what people are trying to tell you. Mm-hmm. That sounds really trivial, I guess. You know, it's not like get a good banker or whatever, but
it's really practical as a designer. And do you remember a pivotal moment in your experience where you recognized empathy was important and you needed to practice it differently?
It's probably around, so when I was building bicycles, this is a long time ago, but when I was building bicycles, I started to be approached by a lot of women to get high performance bicycles made. And at the time there weren't any bikes that fit women. And generally smaller women were approaching me for that. And I didn't understand that at first. And I actually became kind of specialized in building high performance bicycles for athletes who were pretty small people or else really big people. And what I discovered is that nobody ever listened to these people. You know, they would go in and they would talk to some master bicycle builder and he would look at them and tell them what they needed. And he didn't listen to what they had to say, to incorporate that information into his design. Hmm. And for some reason, I don't know why, I did. And I started to listen a lot to what these people were complaining about. And I started to think really hard about how to solve those problems. And I had to build a kind of an empathy for this. I mean, just because of the simple fact that I'm a pretty big guy and I'm not a woman. So I had to listen really hard and try to understand that really well. So I guess it kind of started early in my mm-hmm. career.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. And if you could go back and tell yourself one thing to, you know, listen better and practice empathy. And, you know, my background is electrical engineering originally. And somehow it seems like all engineers come out of school, at least my school, thinking that we know how to solve every problem in the world, right? Yeah. There's a fair bit of arrogance as a young engineering student, at least in my case. And I think because of that, we don't listen. We're not good listeners because we kind of presume we know how to solve the problems ahead of time. And taking time to practice empathy is good wisdom.
Yeah, I wonder what that is. You know, I guess I'm, I'm an engineer also, and, you know, engineers can tend to be very prescriptive. And I'm not sure why engineers can actually solve any kind of a problem you give them if you give it to them in the right way and right. or challenge them the right way. And, maybe that should be included in the engineering curriculum as some kind of empathy stuff.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And on your bike frames, just for listeners, as I was doing research for this, you were making these in, what, 1990 or so, the 90s?
I built bike frames from 1984 to 1999, the very end of 1999.
And you still find these frames, and they say Mark Zay on the
stem. There's still a few around.
There are, and I came across some on eBay sites, and they have a really good reputation.
Yeah, there's some collectors.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
As listeners know, I often wrap up with an innovation quote. What was a quote that you wanted to share with us, and why did you choose that one?
So there's a quote that I really like, and I think it goes pretty well with what I've said earlier. It's from a Hungarian guy he's credited as the discoverer of vitamin C and the some key aspects of cell metabolism, specifically the citric acid cycle. His name is Albert Szentgyörgyi, and he's, I think I pronounced that okay-ish.
That sounded good to me.
And he says, supposedly, discovery consists of seeing what everyone else has seen, but thinking what no one else has thought. And that resonates with me really well because that's true. Discovery consists, everybody sees the same stuff. All the information around you is available to everyone. And it's really a question of how you synthesize that information, how you think about it.
Right.
How many of your own assumptions you're willing to question.
Yeah, it's amazing. Every now and then a product will come out and we all go, why did anyone think about that before? It was so, it solved such an obvious problem.
Exactly.
So excellent. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And just to wrap up, anything you want to leave the listeners with and anyone that is curious about your work, if you have a website that you want to share or information like that?
Anything I want to leave the listeners with? Well, not really. I guess, I'm actually impressed that you're doing a series about design thinking and particularly about sort of invention and product development. I think that kind of information should be much more broadly disseminated. I think it's really cool you're doing this. I have a personal website that people can look at. It's www. And I have a very poorly picked name here. markzeinnovation.com. That's all one word. Markzeh innovation. All one word. It's a personal website. I work for Bose Corporation in their research and concept development group now. So I'm not consulting any longer, but you can kind of get a flavor for what I've done in the past there.
Very good. Mark, I really appreciate your time with us today and your work in design thinking and sharing those ideas in PDMA's new book on that and sharing some of the common sense with us.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
I call my listeners Everyday Innovators, not just because it is the name of this podcast, but because I believe we need people who are innovating every day and who approach problems in an innovative manner. And that is you. Thank you so much for listening. Please tell your colleagues who are interested in product development and innovation to listen too. Also, thanks to productinnovationeducators.com, your one source for online product management and innovation training to help you stand out in your profession. To find the show notes and details of the discussion, go to theeverydayinnovator.com/041.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.